Leroy Vinegar. Benny Bailey.
Welcome to Living Writers here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is Frank Uhle sitting in for T. Hetzel, who is the normal host of this show. And our special guest this afternoon is Danny Plotnick, a filmmaker, film professor, author, who is presenting a program of his own Super 8 movies this Saturday night at the Riverside Arts Center in Ypsilanti at 7 p.m. as part of the IFFI Film Festival. Welcome to the show, Danny Plotnick.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. It's good to be here.
We're excited to see this program of your films. And one of the elements of your film has recently been preserved by the Smithsonian Institution. Is that not so?
That is an incredibly true story. Yeah, the one of the very first films I made when I was a student at the University of Michigan back in 1986, we made a short film on Super 8 called Skate Witches, which is now internet famous. And the leather jacket that we made for the film, one of the wardrobe props created for the film, caught the eye of the Smithsonian, and it's now part of their permanent collection. I think they're doing a big skateboarding exhibit coming up, as kind of a touring skateboard exhibit, and it's going to be part of that. And it's just pretty wild, pretty ridiculous, pretty wild, but very cool.
That is pretty amazing. And my understanding is the skate witches in the movie weren't like Tony Hawk level skateboarders. Is that also true?
Yeah, that is also true. Yeah, the thing with that film that's interesting is it kind of came out of one of the women in the film. We were all going to Ann Arbor. We were all students there. And she was like, oh, I should bring my skateboard, up from home so I can just get around campus more easily, because, right, it's a big campus. And she was just reluctant because she just felt she was going to be hassled by all the guy skateboarders, because there really weren't any women skateboarding at the time. And one of our other friends is like, oh, I have a skateboard in Grand Rapids. I should bring mine. And I was like, yeah, you guys should just form a gang and call yourself the Skate Witches. And our other friend was like, well, hey, I don't skate, but I would definitely join your gang. And so, they weren't even, professional skateboarders by any means. They just wanted to skate to just whatever, get around town. And so that just became the jumping off point for the movie, or the inspiration to make this ridiculous movie about a gang of female skateboarders.
And was it also a coincidence?
And then during the film, there was one woman who didn't skate, and then there was one woman who just didn't want to skate on camera. And so, the whole thing just sort of snowballed. But it then, once I uploaded it to the internet in the mid-2000s, it really took off, especially with young women skateboarders. It was really inspirational to just sort of see some women, not necessarily for their skating skills, but just being these like strong women in the 80s kind of talking about those issues, even if they weren't specifically talking about those issues. It was all kind of implied, within the body of the film. And the song, you know, it's been sampled. The mm-hmm. film has been sampled in a lot of songs. There's been a lot of comics. a number of bigger skateboard groups have taken their name from the Skate Witches, and it's this whole kind of weird internet phenomena that there's a recent book published by a woman called Natalie Porter about women skateboarding, which is called Girl Gang Zines and Power Slides. And she had interviewed me for that. She had interviewed one of the Skate Witches for that. And this sort of Smithsonian came to the film through, you know, that, through that book, through that writer. And yeah,
that's amazing.
And the rest is modern American history.
Was it a coincidence or not that the Skate Witches all seem to have pet rats?
Was that made up for the movie? We all have pet rats. No, those are all our pet rats. Karen, the woman who plays the Queen Witch, she just had a menagerie of animals in her house, including a pet rat. We were like, oh my God, that's so cool. And so we all had pet rats. And so that just seemed like an obvious thing to put them in the movie.
Brilliant.
I mean, it's so funny too, because also it seemed obvious, but it didn't seem like a big deal at the time. But now I think that's one of the favorite things that people love about the movie, is that we have these pet rats, and we always get questions about, are those really your pet rats? And it's like, well, yeah, they were just like our pet rats. What's the big deal? Right? Didn't everyone have pet rats back in the 80s?
No, you've got to have, I'm sure there's some formula that's been created to have something be a hit, but you've got to have like two hooks and then a third thing that like puts it over the top. And it's like, okay, I dig the skateboarders, I dig the punk rock attitude and the jacket, but when they talk about the pet rats, I'm like, okay, this is too much.
Yeah, I'm in, I'm sold.
So getting back to the way before you made that film, and we're here to talk about also many things, but you were a student here at U of M in the film department, and in your book, you talk about how the film program at that time in the early 80s was pretty threadbare. And I wrote a book called Cinema Ann Arbor, and I talked to people who were in the film program then, and they were like, yeah, there was a couple cameras and not a whole lot of great editing gear.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I interviewed Jonathan Timon, mm-hmm. who was one of my professors, who mm-hmm. I mean, the first person to put a Super 8 camera in my hand. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he told me that struck me as really interesting is that one of the reasons he came to Ann Arbor is because of all the great festivals that we had. Like, mm-hmm. it was this amazing place to watch films. Mm-hmm. But what he quickly found out is not a lot of people were actually making films, or especially, you know, within the university setting. And so one of his goals was to bring more production to the program. But it sounds like he was running around town buying Super 8 cameras so the program could have Super 8 equipment.
Wow.
And again, this is all the stuff like when you're 18 or 19 or 20, you don't know and you don't see. But I do remember there were actually some really good filmmakers who came out of that program at that time. Mm-hmm. But I was someone who I was taking it seriously. I wanted to do this stuff. And I always joke, like, we would make sound film, but there wasn't a sound projector that we could play wow. them back on. And often I'd have to track Jonathan down to be like, could I borrow your sound projector? He's like, yeah, I'm going to be playing softball at this park. You know, I'll bring it along. Come find me. And it's like, you know, as a 19-year-old, like, you're going to your professor's softball game to like get a projector out of the trunk of his car. It just seemed so crazy, but you know, it's sort of just what you did. What one did.
You're currently the head of film program at University of San Francisco, so I got to ask you, does that happen today? Is there a student who knocks on your door at 10 o'clock at night?
What I will say with the internet and email, students are indeed emailing me at all hours.
That's true.
And because of our weird internet addiction, I don't know why I am constantly checking my work email mm-hmm. at 10 at night.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, what's interesting is we have a really great film program, all this great digital equipment,
mm-hmm.
and we do still teach some 16 millimeter Bolex stuff. I do still shoot Super 8 with my students.
Nice.
Most of the Super 8 gear is mine, and the university has bought some, but mm-hmm. I keep it all in my office because the woman who runs our lab's fantastic, but she's not a big analog person. So like when we actually do our Super 8 classes, I'll be like, come to my office and I'll give you the equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just somehow easier for me to do that. And even I'll have a lot of students who want to keep making Super 8 films. And I'm always like, you can borrow the cameras over the summer and, you know, I'll hand them off to you just mm-hmm. because the equipment facility is closed. So weirdly, there still is some of that kind of DIY spirit going.
Nice.
But that's also just like part of my makeup at this point. Mm-hmm. And even from those formative experiences. So, yeah.
No, I mean, that's, you know, speaking as a person who works here at the University of Michigan in the AV tech support unit, you know, there's classes where that I can see where the students' engagement is heightened by some kind of DIY aspects. I mean, there's a class my good friend Matthew Solomon teaches in early film, and they actually do a Melez style trick film with, they shoot it in 35 millimeter. He just started this a year ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So like
wow.
in a week or so, we're going to actually screen a 35 millimeter print that these students, you know, like a minute and a half long, film where some guy comes out dressed in a cape and then he, you know, pulls up a sheet and there's a woman underneath it and he puts the sheet back down and pulls it again and there's a skeleton underneath it, you know, and we actually, are,
yeah.
The students are going to splice that. I had to loan them some splicing gear. They're going to splice the original 35, the film, I don't know if it's Kodak anymore even, but whoever's processing the print is providing them with what's called a dailies print. So they're getting a projectable
yeah.
35 millimeter print.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
Well,
but I can see how the
amazing.
Students are so engaged by that. It's just much more exciting.
Well, yeah. And the analog, I mean, equipment, because it's all so old at this point, becomes really precious, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I feel like I have to keep an eye on it in a certain way. Like it cannot take the abuse
wow.
that our newer equipment can, because mm-hmm. It's not that it's irreplaceable, but it is a pain in the ass to have to replace, right? If someone drops a camera, right, which people have, it's
ugh.
Like, oh my God, I got to now spend $400 finding a camera that may or may not work, you know?
Mm-hmm. So are you using like kind of consumer grade, like old, you know, battery operated cartridge Super 8 cameras, like the kind of I had in high school myself, or
yep.
are there better
yep.
ones?
Yep. No, pretty much the same ones. And I have a range of stuff from, we're using Elmos and Canons, and
mm-hmm.
I have a Beaulieu as well
mm-hmm.
that was actually given to me by one of the guys who helped develop Super 8 in the 60s. And I tell that story
mm-hmm.
in the book.
Yeah, I want to I really want to get to the book in a second because
yeah.
I not recommend it highly enough. I mean, I haven't done deep research, but I don't imagine there's another book on Super 8 film and out there at all. And certainly yours is the definitive version, I would say. Is that how you feel about it?
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, there are other Super 8 books, and there's a guy in Germany named Jürgen Lassau who's actually published a bunch of them, but I feel this one is very different. And
mm-hmm.
At some point as I was kind of thinking about, you know, writing this book, and again, I made Super 8 films for, you know, 15, 20 years, you know, things that became what I would think of as fairly technically sophisticated. Like I just had a deep knowledge of that world. And when I was coming up, even in Ann Arbor in the mid 80s, people were always like, oh, you got to read the Lenny Lipton book, the
mm-hmm.
Super 8 book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd read the Lipton book and it just didn't seem to relate
mm-hmm.
to anything that was happening. Like that book, which is amazing. I can't
mm-hmm.
recommend it enough now.
Yeah.
But it was made in the mid 70s at the height of Super 8 technology. That's when Super 8 was really happening. And I'd read this book about all this technology that didn't seem to exist anymore. You couldn't go to the store and buy this stuff. I mean, it was still out there, but I started making films in 1985, which is essentially the last year any new equipment was made, and it was already at that point kind of a dying medium, sort of in its early death throes. And so to read about all this great equipment that was out there that you couldn't really get, or you'd have to kind of bump into in a lucky way, or maybe it didn't exist in Southeast Michigan, you know, in an easy way, that book felt irrelevant to me. There was a really great book called Super Ain't the Video Age by Bob Brodsky and Tony Treadway, which to me was the Bible for how to make films in the mid-80s. And that book was really great. That book is irrelevant in the 2020s because we don't have any of the equipment they're talking about anymore. And I didn't want to get into making a book that was sort of this technical how-to, because I feel that shifts and changes so quickly. And so for me, what I really wanted to do was talk to artists and get into what the creative process was and how the technology of the time affected how you worked and how you functioned and how you made film as an artist. And so the book has, you know, 25, 30 interviews with artists who made their name or kind of made a career or got their start working with Super 8 and being passionate about Super 8. And then I balance that with a lot of my own stories and sort of some technical how-to of how things were made back in the day, because one of the things I find as I teach, students are fascinated by this. How did you work? How did you function? I want to make Super 8 films. And I was always like, you have no idea how difficult it was to make work of a certain quality when you had no money and you were working with technology that, while it was really good, was ultimately a home movie medium, and you had to be really creative and clever and push it to its limitations. And I think that's interesting from a historical perspective. So kind of wanted the creative artistry side of things, how things were made in the back of the day from maybe a media archaeology perspective, and then make it this kind of beautiful coffee table book with a lot of great images and ephemera, you know, from the time, because we all love that kind of look, you know.
No, absolutely. And I want to just do a little quick music pause for our listeners and then get our thoughts together and be back. And then I want to talk more about the book and the graphics, the design of the book, because it's just a stunning book. We're talking to Danny Plotnick, the author of Super 8, An Illustrated History, out from Rare Bird Books in 2020. And Danny will be appearing at the Riverside Arts Center this Saturday night with his amazing movies in a retrospective at 7 o'clock. So you can check that out as part of the IFFI Film Festival. And we'll be back very shortly. Destroy. And we're talking to Danny Plotnick. Who's the artist that does that tune?
That was a group called The Faction. Actually, I think they're from San Jose, California.
Okay, yeah. And that is...
So local to me now, not then.
Yes. And that is the theme song from the classic Skate Witches, which we presented when Danny appears at the Riverside Arts Center as part of the IFFI Film Festival on Saturday night. And... Oh, go ahead.
And, you know, I should say the funny thing about that song, too, is I mean, you know, back then I just, like, any kind of music in my films I would just take from, like, you know, records that I really liked and not really think about rights and things like that. And there was some point where, like, now that this film is its own kind of, like, meme factory, like, oh, I wonder if those guys either A, know about this film or are somewhat irritated that they never got paid, you know, and at some point I did reach out to them and they're like, hey, and they were really cool with it.
Awesome.
Again, to be clear, not that I've made any money on this film, but right there is always that perception of like, hey, this guy just took my music and now it's like all over the place and we never saw a penny, but they were very cool.
That's like you're like Kenneth Anger in Scorpio Rising or something. All of a sudden, oops.
Yeah.
But I want to talk more about your book because I bought it when it came out, and I'm sure there were people who lined up because they really wanted a book about Super 8. As a person who myself made some very primitive Super 8 films, which are far less accomplished than the ones of yours that I've seen. But, you know, everyone was out in the backyard with their little camera and they're, okay, you know, stand over there. Okay, you're the monster, you know. And, you know, we had so much fun making those movies. And the book is, one of the things I like a lot about the book is it's just a loving tribute. And it's not, as you were talking maybe about some of the earlier books that were more attempting to make a case for Super 8 as like a professional grade, you know, or somehow art form. Your book is fun. There's a lot of great pictures that are of the equipment, color, you know, full page with a cool color background of different cameras and projectors and things. And, you know, and the interviews, which you've mentioned, there's so many great interviews. And you track down people that were instrumental in the whole field. I mean, this is one of the things where I feel really your book does serve as kind of a state-of-the-art definitive book because... I mean, you track down a guy who's, I guess, a World War II veteran who was helped develop Super 8 from when it transitioned from so-called regular 8. And tell me about that guy.
Yeah, so one of the last sort of rounds of kind of research I did for the book was going out to Rochester. And I had a good contact from Kodak, who was maybe one of the kind of Kodak Bay Area film reps, who knew that I was working on the book, and he's like, when you go to Rochester, you want to try to get into the Kodak archives, you should talk to this guy, Roly Zavada, who's really great. And so I reached out to him. The whole experience in Rochester was fantastic, mm-hmm. working with both at the George Eastman House and then at Kodak, and those are separate entities. And Roly Zavada invited me out to his house. He was in his, I want to say, early to mid-90s mm-hmm. at that point.
Wow.
And one of the things that's really fascinating that we kind of forget that Kodak was one of the biggest tech companies in the world. And when you kind of go back through their archives, you see all their advertisements trying to recruit engineers, technicians, people with kind of chemistry backgrounds, right? Wow. These are the people creating the cameras, creating the film stocks, creating the chemistry, and just, you know, all the kind of behind the scenes elements that makes the photography process work. And he was one of those guys who was at Kodak in the 50s I don't know when he retired, probably, you know, probably very late in the game, but mm-hmm. he's someone who worked on the development of Kodachrome, right? Wow. This beloved film stock. He was one of the guys sort of at the ground floor. No, not at the development of Kodachrome, but maybe its move to the kind of K2 process in the 50s. And like one of the things he told me was, he was like, yeah, he didn't like how saturated and hyper-real the colors were, but they did that because that's what National Geographic wanted, right? So something that was just going to pop more on the page, where I think for him, it's like it didn't seem as natural, right, as it should, but they were also then working with these other, you know, big clients of theirs to deliver something for them. He told me this great story about when they redesigned Tri-X at some point in the late 50s or 60s, that the impetus for that was they needed a film stock that they could process right away or very quickly to determine the photo finishes at horse races.
Wow.
Right? And so he's like, yeah, I spent all summer going to the track in wow. Rochester, you know, and so it was just things like that that were, you know, that were really wild. And one thing I remember, this didn't come from him, but from there's a book called, I think I want to say it's called Home Movies by Alan Cattell, or Cattell. That's a really good book. And I think in there he talks about when Kodak was developing Super 8, they shot something like 300,000 test rolls.
Oh, my gosh.
And I asked Rolly about that. He's like, oh, yeah, we would just give, like, cameras and test rolls to just the employees over the weekend. Just go shoot something this weekend with your family. Just go shoot some kind of home movie stuff. Again, is they're just trying to kind of dial in what that process, you know, is mm-hmm. or what, you know, what challenges they're mm-hmm. facing. And so just, you know, the employees are you know, using, you know, just, you know, being they're the testers, you know, for the equipment. I mean, but he was ground floor on just the development of Super 8 and trying to get a universal standard for Super 8 as mm-hmm. well.
Now that amount of research just that the company was doing speaks to the amount, the size of Kodak and its dominance in the camera field, in the film field, that they could spend yeah. that much money just, you know, dialing in the new Super 8. And I guess, yeah. you know, I don't know how many. Do you ever find out how many people actually had Super 8 cameras at the height in the early 70s? Because I had one, you know, I knew a bunch of people that had them.
Yeah, I don't think there's an exact number, mm-hmm. and there definitely is some speculation. And I did, mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like I have that number in the book.
No, I'm just curious because it seemed like it was pervasive at the time. And you know, you did the same thing I did in high school, you know, oh, here's this camera, you know, let's make a film. And mine, I actually purchased for the express purpose of making my own little crude home movies. But other people, you know, it was like their dad's camera to make the pictures of the birthday party, and they would sneak it out and make a monster movie in the backyard, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was definitely, you know, what was going on. I think at some point, Phil Vigiant, who runs Pro 8mm Labs, he kind of came up with a number where, like, sort of the average person shot, like, 3 rolls per year. And it was Christmas and like, a couple birthdays.
Right.
Right, that was sort of, you know, this sort of average, just of the way it ultimately got used.
Yeah, and, you know, again, one of the things I think we're both fond of is the analog look and the feel. I mean, the fact that, you know, even though it's grainy, and in the earlier ones, certainly there's no sound, you know, when you watch those movies, there's just something different from watching an iPhone video. I mean, there's the fragility and a kind of window into a lost world from just like the whole movie side.
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons my students love to shoot Super 8 and even 16, and why I think there's also just this analog resurgence in general, especially with still photography, is that it just looks appreciably different mm-hmm. than this digital world that they've grown up with and that we've definitely been subsumed by for the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me, right? Because for years, digital video was chasing the look of film, and it certainly got there, right? I mean, they look the same. But now when you look at some of the more amateur or independent film gauges like Super 8 and 16, it just looks so different than, again, this digital world. And again, that's exciting for our students because they've grown up in a world where all the images look the same. And right, I love my iPhone. I love the mm-hmm. photos it takes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you send, you know, when you go out on vacation and you take your picture of, you know, whatever you're taking your picture of on vacation, it's going to look pretty much exactly the same as the picture that the next person over from you is taking. Mm-hmm. And it's going to look the same from the next picture that the next person over from them is taking. And so I think when students say shoot analog, it's just this refreshing. It's like a new color in the palette, right? It's sort of a new tool in their arsenal, and it's just really exciting, right? There's a numbing sameness to the way everything looks now, and it looks great, but there's just a sameness to it.
Yeah, another interesting thing, and I've just been thinking as we've been talking, you know, when we were making those films, you weren't sharing them on the internet. So people, you weren't watching other people's work, and you were making your own work, and you might have been in a film class and you'd see some other people in the class's work, but you were kind of creating things out of whole cloth. You know, you were obviously, a lot of the kids were inspired by, we saw Jaws and we saw Star Wars, so let's make a backyard version, or let's take our G.I. Joes and our Barbies and stop motion them. But it really was, I remember as a kid thinking, oh, how am I going to make, you know, I've got this backyard, and I've got these friends of mine who are various degrees of weird looking people or whatever. And you had to make it up, and you weren't sitting there with a YouTube or an Instagram feed of thousands of people's videos that you were trying to sort of fit into that mold.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing too, and I just did a lecture with another class the other day, and we were talking about this, is that the generation coming up now too, not only do they have access to all of that, they also have grown up watching so much more media and movies than we did, right? Mm-hmm. They're all of the generation now who grew up with DVDs. And like our son, who really loves films growing up, every birthday, every holiday, oh, we're going to give you that DVD of your favorite movie. And so he has watched his favorite movies like 100 times. So his understanding of film language, or these kids' understanding of film language, is so much more advanced than our understanding of how you would actually put a movie together. My early films, there's some questionable editing moments where it's like, what was I thinking? Like, I didn't know. Like, I remember one scene in particular from one of my first films where, like, it's a couple and they're bowling and she's got to get 5 pins and they're going to win the tournament, and like she rolls a gutter ball, and the way I cut it is she rolls, the ball goes into the gutter, we see the pin setter go down, and then we cut back to her husband who's like rooting around, and then, oh, crushing defeat. And and it doesn't make any sense because we've already seen it go into the gutter ball. And I just needed to intercut those shots, and it didn't occur to me, or I remember cutting it going, like, I think this kind of works. I don't know. And I look at it now, and it's like, what were you thinking? But it's like, I didn't know because I just hadn't seen as many movies, or you know. And so... yeah, I mean, so I think there's that point too. But, I think kind of, back to this sort of original question of like figuring it out and kind of, having to kind of create this sort of full cloth experience is, when I started making, again, a film like Skate, which is, what was I inspired by? And so like part of it was my friends were in bands. They were kind of in punk bands or garage bands. And, like, that was really exciting to me. And the energy of that kind of movement and youth culture, I wanted to make films that had that energy and that vibe. But I didn't really know any contemporary stuff that was doing that. Now, there certainly was, but I just hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen the No Wave films. I hadn't seen the Cinema of Transgression films, even though those were out there. I hadn't yet seen the George Cukor films. I hadn't yet seen the John Waters film. So there were certainly precedents, but it was non-existent to me. What was existent was the music. Or in Michigan, there was a great instructor, Herb Eagle, who taught like a Russian and Eastern European film class. And I saw Davies by Vera Hidalova. I saw W.R. or The Mysteries of the Organism by Dusan Makhachev, and it's like, oh, those films had this very, to me, punk rock anarchy kind of energy. W.R. right has Tuli Kupferberg's in there, Jackie Curtis is in there, and it's like, whoa, right? There's an ice skater who gets her head cut off. I mean, like, there's all these kinds of like crazy ideas that resonated, right, to me.
Oh, yeah.
So I think back then there were interesting things coming through, but it was weird shards of stuff from all these different eras.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, okay, I'm going to take all of that stuff that's floating out there and then try to create something that makes sense to me. And that's how I'm going to try to kind of approach it.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing how I would probably was, you know, watch a little Monty Python on TV or something.
Monty Python.
Saw a couple movies on TV. But Herb Eagle is still here teaching, by the way. And he's teaching some
Herb
of those
Eagle
same
is
films.
Still there teaching?
He is.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
that's
you should
amazing.
Say hi to him when you're in town. I want to take a quick music break and we'll come back talking to Danny Plotnick here on Living Writers. Frank Hewley sitting in for T. Hetzel. But let's hear one more tune.
Sometimes I'm down, sometimes I'm fine.
And we are back here on Living Writers with Danny Plotnick. What was that tune, Danny?
That was a song called Nervous Guy by a San Francisco band called Icky Boyfriends.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1996, I made a film with the Icky Boyfriends, pretty much my longest film. That's not true, but a 49-minute Super 8 mini rock epic.
Cool.
Starring no-fi, lo-fi band Icky Boyfriends, so, and we showed that at Ziggy's in Ypsilanti at the beginning of March. The programmers there are a big fan of that film, and as we were getting ready for my show next week, depending how you do the math, depending what you count as a film, I probably have two and a half hours worth of short films.
Mm-hmm.
Too much for one program. Mm-hmm. And so one way around just having the one program, we added a second screening back in March to kind of that featured that film as well as a couple other shorts that I made in Ann Arbor back in the 80s as well. So that was cool. A more kind of rock focused block.
And the ones that are playing this Saturday at the Riverside Arts Center, we've been talking about Skate Witches, but tell me some of the other ones.
There's another film called Dumbass from Dundas, which is the first film I made when I moved out to San Francisco. So that was exciting. There's another film called Steel Belted Romeos, which is sort of one of my biggest films for a while. There's a film called Pillow Talk, which I made with another Ann Arbor alum named Laura Rosso. We got a film called Swingers Serenade that was really my only 16-millimeter film. That's the longest film on the program. That's 23 minutes. That is based on a script that was in an old home movie magazine from the 1960s. That was a very weird, somewhat randy script that was geared towards the home movie market with the idea that families would make this film together somehow. It's very weird. It's a very weird setup. So
cool.
We got that one on there and a couple others as well. So I think the whole program is about 80, 85, 86 minutes.
And you'll be here in person introducing it.
Yes. And we'll also have all the Skate Witches will be there. The first time we've all been in a room together in about 40 years
Amazing.
Or about 39 years. So that's going to be fun.
So, are you installing like a skateboard ramp so they can like do some tricks for
instead
us?
Instead of the red carpet, come down
just wondered.
On a ramp. Yeah.
That's going to be so awesome. I mean, again, do all three of the Skate Witch ladies live around this area still?
Two of them do. One lives in Whitmore Lake.
Okay.
and Dana owns the tattoo shop in Ann Arbor near the Fleetwood, Lucky Monkey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One of them lives kind of outside of Grand Rapids, and the third skate wish, Jenny, lives in the Northwest.
Okay.
And she's just going to come in. She still has family. You know, when this happened, I like reached out to her. I'm like, hey, do you still ever visit Michigan? Do you still have family there? Because if so, you should come for this thing. And she's going to do it. So
that is amazing.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that really makes this a special event. And I will say I have been involved with both of these 8mm film festival that we used to have here. And
yeah.
It ran from about 1971 to about 1990. Which you won an award at the very last one. Is that not true?
That is true. So Steel Belted Romeos won like the best film or best experimental film in that last one.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dumbass from Dundas, which I also mentioned, won an honorable mention in, must have been 1988 or 89. So the last two festivals.
Mm-hmm.
I should say they did reject Skate Witches when I submitted it. So I'm still a little irritated with them about that, but that's okay.
All right. Well, I hope John Timon's listening because he's got some.
I don't think John wasn't a programmer
okay.
at that time.
Okay. He's got a. We'll find out who was involved.
He's gonna be at the show though.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's funny because I talked to someone who was in the Ann Arbor Film Festival screening committee in 1964. They were the jurors, and they rejected Scorpio Rising in 1964 from the Ann Arbor Film Festival screening committee. Oh, it's not good enough to show at our festival. And of course, the legendary, one of the most legendary films they added it at the last minute. But again, your film.
But I love those stories. It's awful when it's happening to you, but it's also like, you know, I work with a lot of, you know, early career filmmakers, you know, and like, being an artist, it's a humiliating gig, right?
Mm-hmm,
I mean, there's just so much rejection and all of that thing that you just have to fight through. And it's like very hard, especially when you're starting and you're trying to establish who you are, to get some of the negative feedback and the rejection. And it just goes to show there's been a lot of, you know, great art that on first contact people didn't like. And, you know, it doesn't actually necessarily reflect the true worth of the piece.
No. Who's the guy at Decca Records who was like, we're not, no one's interested in groups anymore. We don't want the Beatles to sign infamously or whatever. So I have to ask the question, are you projecting these on Super 8 or are we getting digital transfers?
You know, we are not digital transfers, and it's funny because it's been a minute since I've looked at some of these on Super 8, but there's new kind of 4K scans of everything.
Yeah.
So I've been kind of excited to revamp, restore those a little bit.
I'm curious about that because I know in your book you show examples of how Skate Witches was spliced together. And the crude splices that you did, there's an illustration of how one of them is separated a little bit, and you were doing like a side of the film splice and to preserve the sound. And I think even in the book you talk about it, at the time when you published the book, you didn't have anything more than like a VHS era scan of Skate Witches. Did you recently redo it in 4K?
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, the thing about, you know, a lot of this work is there's just sort of different iterations of transfers over the years, but I have all the original Super 8s are in pretty good shape.
Okay.
And so my work is being archived these days at USC. The archivist there, Dino Everett, is doing an incredible job, especially, and he's really focused on preserving small gauge stuff and punk rock stuff. Like, he has a whole, people remember the Target video collection.
Mm-hmm.
He has that work. And so he reached out to me at some point. And so he has all of the films. And so he's been getting me new scans of things. And often the challenges that I have with that is, though the films are in really good shape, I did show the Super 8s for years. Some of the films I had Super 8 prints of, so the originals are in pretty good shape, But there is some scratching on the originals, or what I'm really running into a lot now is the tape splices have stretched a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So this film Pillow Talk is the last one that I just restored. Like at every edit, there's a little white flash because there's just a gap at the edit points. And had I gone in, I probably could have re-edited them to tighten that up.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's like, oh, that looks pretty bad. I have to fix that. There is, the films also have certain imperfections, and I do have to kind of do a little dance of, do I fix that imperfection?
Mm.
Right? That's an imperfection I never wanted, but that is part of the film, right? That's the part of the historical record of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Do I clean it up to get it to where I envisioned it before I shot it, or do I clean it up to get it to be truthful to what the ultimate projected film was, right? So you have some of those questions too.
No, you don't want to go all George Lucas on it and you know, redo the special effects or whatever. Have the skateboards like a rocket on them or something.
Yeah. Well, and Skate Witches is a funny one because, like, it in the beginning of that film, if you're to see that film, we recorded the song, which we played earlier, Skate mm-hmm. Destroyed by the Faction. We added that to the opening credits by plugging in a tape deck into the projector, hitting record on the projector, pushing in the record button. And the record button on my projector just made this kind of noise.
Right.
Actually, when you disengaged it, and that's on the film. So as the song cuts out, you just hear, and then I'm like, oh man, like that has bugged me since day one.
Yeah.
And like, okay, I could actually clean that out. I could go get, a digital version of that song.
Mm-hmm.
I could put it on. I could fade it out perfectly. But then I'm like, oh my God, people probably love that imperfection, and I'll get yelled at for fixing that. So like, that's one, like, I'm going to leave that in. I mm-hmm. could clean that up in 5 seconds, but I'm going to leave it because, right, that's part of the historical record of what that film is.
No, that, I admire you for doing that, because there's definitely lots of people who are, no, I've got to fix it. And, you know, the DIY charm is erased by creating a sanitized version of something.
Yeah, and there's definitely some of those kinds of things I'm cleaning up, you know, where there's always been a shot in Pillow Talk that I kind of cringe at. Like, ugh, so bad. And I just, like, took it out.
Mm.
Like, I was like, you know what? No one's going to know. But that's also not a film mm-hmm. that people care about in that way, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, with Skate Witches, I'm like, well, okay. Like, I'm not really going to clean up much of anything. There might be one or two teeny little things that
right.
no one's going to notice. You know, kind of some micro decisions, losing a frame here or there.
Mm-hmm.
But...
yeah, I wonder if the guys in the Kingsmen ever thought about when they had to perform Louie Louie for the billionth time, leaving in the false start, right? There's a false start where the instrumental break ends and the guy starts singing, and then, oh, wait, go for another bar.
Yeah.
And then he starts singing.
Anyway, yeah.
But yeah, you know, that is part of the charm of that piece of work. And it the completely like haphazard nature.
Yeah.
And again, with Skate Witches, I mean, you know, it's definitely got some crude stuff. Like the woman who does, you know, pushes the guy off the skateboard. I think the second time you're like, well, okay, is that the same shot or something? There's two shots that are kind of similar. It's like, why didn't they come up with a better, you know, new skate tactic or something?
Yeah. Yeah, no, and there's those moments throughout. And, you know, the other thing that I feel like back in the day when, you know, there wasn't as much media being produced, is that
mm-hmm.
I think things that were passionate kind of jumped to the top of the queue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it didn't have to be perfect as mm-hmm. long as it was passionate,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think with my film, that sort of passion comes through.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, looking back, there's always like, oh, what was I thinking? Or like, oh, that's so sloppy, or, you know, but it's like, well, that's just what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Just, and, you know, and another thing I'll talk to my students about a lot is like, you can let trying to be perfect get in your way of actually finishing anything. Mm-hmm. Nothing's ever going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And you can become paralyzed by this quest for perfection. And sometimes you can't let perfect get in the way of good, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. it just has to be good enough, because you're hopefully in your life, you're making a lot of things. And this one thing you're making isn't the be all end all thing that you are going to be judged on, mm-hmm. right? But the thing you're making is just going to be a building block to the next thing and to the next thing and to the next thing. And you're going to keep getting better and mm-hmm. better and better. But if you don't finish that first thing, you're not going to start that journey. So you just got to be like, okay, this is good enough, and we have to move on now.
Mm-hmm. No, that I am so glad to hear you teach that, because that really is a problem, you know, and you know, for artists to be able to step back and say, you know, the work is a piece of work, and it's not a perfect reflection of me, and I, you know, people won't judge me if it's every aspect of it isn't it flawless in some way. Because it just, it loses, the air is sucked right out of it, and it just feels like one of those, you know, Devo's sixth album or something, where you're just like, wow, it just doesn't have any passion or soul to it. So one thing I just want to make sure, we're nearing the end of Living Writers here. We're talking with Danny Plotnick. The book that you have out, which we talked a lot about, the film program you're going to do in your films, but I really want to talk more, a little bit more about your book, because yeah. it is, you know, you got some of these people. You got Richard Linklater, you got an interview with him. You dug up, you know, some people who had made Super 8 films in the heyday, and it's just in a very amazing, enlightening book. And you know, how did you, like, for example, someone like Richard Linklater, I mean, did you have an inside connection, or how did you get a hold of him?
You know, the connection I had with Richard is, there's a photographer, filmmaker named Bill Daniel, lived in the Bay Area for a long time. He's back here, but he's a Texas guy. Mm-hmm. And his brother is Lee Daniel, who shot all of Richard Linklater's early films.
Okay.
But the thing that was great is Bill, in the mid to late 80s, would run programs of San Francisco films back to Austin, and Austin films up to San Francisco, right? Like back in those days where you had those little kind of cultural exchanges between mm-hmm. city. In San Francisco, it was between San Francisco and Austin and San Francisco and Portland. And Bill took my films down there. And in the back of my mind, and I love Richard Linklater films, I'm like, I bet Richard Linklater has seen my films. I don't know. Like, I see, like, you know, just you always have those kind of thoughts. And so I was able to get Richard's contact through Bill, and Richard responded, or his people responded right away. And then as soon as I talked to him, he was like, hey, I remember seeing your films back at the Austin Film Co-op in the late 80s. And it was such a kind of classy move, because that put me at ease. Like, mm-hmm. I think he's one of the best directors out there.
Amazing.
And so I'm a little starstruck with him, and mm-hmm. like most of the other people I talk to, they're not such huge names, and so like I can be really easeful with them, but mm-hmm. that was one where like my wife's like, tell him we love the Before movies. I'm like, I'm not gonna tell him that, like, you know. And then he's like, oh hey, it's so great to talk to you, I remember seeing your films. And that just put me at ease, and we kind of got into it mm-hmm. and in a great way, and it just put us on the same level in some way. And that was kind of coming from him. And whenever I meet artists who have a bit of a name or mm-hmm. up the chain, and they're really kind to me, mm-hmm. I have to take that forward. I remember meeting Barbara Hammer, the great, you know, experimental director once, and she was so nice to me. I'm like, does Barbara Hammer know me? Like, I was like, why is Barbara Hammer being so mm-hmm. nice to me? And like, oh, she's mm-hmm. just a nice, you know, person who's a class act. And it's like, you know, you're an art star at the film festival, you don't have to be nice to the people younger than you. And mm-hmm. and so when I see that kind of kindness coming from people, I'm like, that's the kind of behavior I need to emulate in my life, you know.
No, that is really neat that you connect with someone somewhat, you know, way above your station, as it were, who's just like, yeah, you know, I dig your movies too. You know, that's awesome.
And it was someone like Linklater too, who was really kind of self-taught in many ways. Like, he's someone who also understood the importance of Super 8 and why Super 8's important. And he made that whole feature-length Super 8 film before Slacker.
Right.
And he was really excited to talk about that, or that process, or that process of being an early career filmmaker trying to do something and having to use this medium because that's what he could afford. Where, again, most people talking to him are certainly, they're starting at Slacker as if Slacker is the first thing. And so it's like, no, there's this other gestation period that's really important. And again, Super 8 being this medium that allowed so many other people to kind of start and get their feet wet and try some things.
Yeah, no, in your book you mentioned the names, but I mean Todd Haynes, you know, Linklater.
Todd Haynes on the if you have the Criterion Safe DVD, there is his, you know, first, you know, kind of big short that's a 20-minute Super 8 sound film that showed at the Ann Arbor 8mm Film Festival.
And won an award.
And I was going through old Super 8 filmmaker magazines. That was a big kind of research of mine, and just to see what films were playing. And at some point, I'm like, oh, there was a Todd Haynes film from, like, it was like 1978. I'm like, it's like, that seems so early. What's that about? And I tried to get through to Todd Haynes, and that almost worked, but that didn't. And that, like, that's a really interesting film too, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a tough watch. I've seen it too on the special features, but it is. Again, we're getting down to the wire here of our time here on Living Writers, but you know, your book, Super 8: An Illustrated History, out from Rare Bird Books in 2020, is a must purchase. And again, it was kind of short circuited by the pandemic, you know, when a lot of books, I know my wife works in publishing, and a lot of books kind of had a real struggle to get noticed when people couldn't go to bookstores and give talks, and it just short-circuited so many of the ways publicity has gotten out. But you will have some copies for sale here, I understand, this Saturday night.
I'll definitely bring a couple with me.
Excellent.
And again, people, you can get them wherever you buy your books. I know Literati in Ann Arbor carried them for a while. The publisher has, you know, all the big distributors, so it's not going to be in store right now, but you could order it, and I'm sure it'll be there within the week as well. Or come down to Ypsilanti, hang out, watch the movies, buy a book,
come on down. There's going to be again, Riverside Arts Center, Saturday the 18th at 7 p.m., Danny Plotnick in-person screening of his Super 8 masterpieces, including the infamous Skate Witches, with the original Skate Witches in person. So inviting everyone to join us for that. I will certainly be there. And thank you so much, Danny Plotnick, for joining us here on Living Writers this afternoon. T. Hetzel, our usual host, gave me this opportunity to sit in for her, which we appreciate. And we're going to go out with a tune. There's so many other topics we could cover, but your lovely wife, Allison, has a recording musical career. And with our mutual friend, Alec Palau, recently produced some tunes, which we are going to go out with. So why don't you introduce this tune for us?
Yeah, so this is a song called Sweet Loneliness. And Allison's also in a lot of my movies, has composed soundtracks for my movies. She's going to be in town as well, so you can introduce her.
Excellent.
And we made a little music video for this song. It's called Sweet Loneliness. Kind of super soulful late 60s early 70s vibe, which
Very
is
cool.
Something her and Alec are going for, and it's a great tune. So hopefully we'll see you all next week. Frank, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Danny. This is a thrill. Your book really is inspiring to me, and I hope folks can pick up copies this weekend.